From Michigan Radio, this is Stateside. I'm Cynthia Canty. Today, easier absentee voting means new challenges for county clerks.
The bottom line is if you have twice as many ballots that you're counting as you were in the past election cycle, you need more time and or you need more machines.
Michigan's future with climate change.
We could have years of really dry, hot summers in Michigan with super wet springs. And we could have more lake effect snow in the winters, but as it continues to get warmer, we could have a lot more rain in the winter.
A Michigan tribe looks beyond casinos.
I think all tribes are facing the challenge that the economy created by casinos isn't as significant as it used to be. It's a shrinking market.
And lessons from the life and death of comic genius Groucho Marx.
But she would control him, boss him around, and she later controlled his estate.
Those stories and much more for you today on Stateside. Hello, and welcome to Stateside. I'm Cynthia Canty. Climate disruption is here. So what does this mean for Michigan's future? That's the question we'll explore all week on Stateside, and we'll kick things off later in the hour. But first, when Michigan voters approved Proposal 3 and made it easier to vote absentee, we clearly intended to take advantage of it. Last week's election found a huge uptick in the number of people voting absentee. And that's meant county clerks are caught in a time crunch, and some are asking for changes in the law. Secretary of State Jocelyn Benson is here with us now. Secretary, would you put this all into a little context for us? How much of an increase did we see in absentee ballots last week? Can you give us some numbers?
Well, more than 120,000 people voted from home in the August 6th election, and that's significantly higher than the last August 6th election, and frankly, in every state, every locality that has gone from requiring citizens to state a reason to get their absentee ballot as we were before to now where anyone can vote from home without having to state a reason, you've seen the amount of people choosing to vote absentee and by mail or from home double quite quickly. And we're seeing exactly that happen. We saw that in the May local elections, where it went from about 30% to 60% of citizens participating in the May election voting absentee. And we're seeing that now in the August election. So it's very clear citizens wanted this change, and they're taking advantage of it now that they have it.
And what did that spike mean for the county clerks who have to count these ballots?
Well, there's, you know, a set period of time in which clerks are able to, in some places, convene absentee counting boards to oversee the process and process these ballots. And in every single other state that has changed from for-reason absentee to no-reason absentee, just as we have, they have expanded the amount of time that clerks have to process these ballots. It doesn't mean you're getting a count any sooner or you even know what the ballots are counting. You're just putting them through the machine. So you're not seeing any results. You're not knowing it, but you have more time to do that so that on election evening, more ballots are counted and people are able to get results. But more importantly, so that you don't have clerks and their volunteers and workers staying up till 3, 4, 5 in the morning or even not sleeping the whole night trying to process these ballots. And that's what we fear will happen if we don't adjust the law to give clerks more time to count the ballots.
Yeah, how's the reality of so many more ballots, absentee ballots, bumping up against existing law?
Well, existing law does not allow people to start counting absentee ballots until after the polls close, and that's when things start getting processed. And what that means is then you have, again, a short window of time to process these ballots. And if we're talking about a doubling of the amount of ballots, I mean, 80% of ballots cast in Rochester Hills in the August election were sent in. That means less people at the polls, so lower, you know, shorter wait times and less ballots being processed at the polls, and all of those ballots shifting to these absentee counting boards centrally located in clerk's offices where you're processing these ballots centrally. And again, you know, even just looking at what every other state has experienced, they've all recognized the need to add more tabulators to process the ballots and increase the number of the space and time that clerks and officials have to process the ballots.
So to get more time to count ballots, you need to change state law. What are you proposing?
I'm proposing legislation, and I'm standing with clerks who are similarly advocating for legislation. This has really come from the clerks. This was first brought to my attention by clerks, particularly clerks in Oakland County, who said, we're going to need more time. And I said, you're closer to this than I am. You know what you need. I stand with you. And then looking to what every other state has done in moving this direction, the data shows that we've got to do this. So with that, I'm calling for legislation, standing with our clerks, saying we need to give people the option, not mandate it, but just give people the option of more hours, more time to count the ballots in the elections. And, you know, if people want to also allocate more funding for high-speed tabulators to process these ballots, that's great, too. The bottom line is if you have twice as many ballots that you're counting as you were in the past election cycle, you need more time and or you need more machines. And so we hope the legislature, particularly former clerks and administrators of elections in the legislature, will get this, will understand this, and will stand with the clerks calling to be able to have this option.
More time on the front end or the back end?
Well, I would prefer more time on the front end to ensure that our results, and this is what every other state has done, to ensure that results are received in a timely fashion. But the bottom line is we just need more time. So I'm open to the conversation to have more time on the back end as well, if it would help ensure that our ballots are counted accurately, effectively, and efficiently.
Emily Lawler's piece in MLive pointed out, talking about the politics, that State Senator Ruth Johnson, your predecessor and now chair of the Senate Election Committee, kind of disagrees with this idea. She thinks counting, especially the front end, counting early would weaken the integrity of the voting process and maybe increase opportunities for cheating. What concerns, if any, would you have to address if the legislature allowed more time for clerks to count votes?
Well, I agree with State Senator Johnson that we need, if we're going to process the ballots at any point in the cycle, it needs to be done securely, which means you should couple the allowance of greater time with security provisions in place and transparency protections to secure those ballots so that you're addressing and eliminating any potential security concerns. That's easy to do. That should be part of the legislation so that, again, any clerks, let's say, who are counting ballots earlier than they are currently allowed to do, can only do so if they meet certain security requirements.
Without any change to the law, how do you expect to address what's going to surely be a much larger number of absentee ballots in the next presidential election?
I think we will see delayed results, potentially delayed several days before we know who has won any statewide election or local election in Michigan. So, you know, this is something that we're sounding the alarm on now, and we have the benefit of seeing other states have gone through this, who've reached the same solution and conclusion. It's to me an easy change to make if you do so securely and carefully. And then again, you make it an option. You know, these election officials work so hard on election day to get us the results of elections securely and accurately and timely. And I think we should be doing everything we can to support them and give them the tools and resources and time they need to meet the expectations of their constituents and voters throughout the state.
Jocelyn Benson, Michigan Secretary of State. Thank you.
Thank you.
Suicide rates are the highest they've been since World War II. That's according to the Centers for Disease Control and Prevention. In the last 20 years, suicides in this country have gone up 30%. But across the country, local crisis hotlines are shutting down, and national companies are taking over. Interlochen Public Radio's Bronte Cook reports.
Third Level Crisis Services is a small nonprofit in Traverse City. For nearly half a century, they've offered a number of services for people in crisis, including a 24/7 crisis hotline. People could call the hotline in any type of crisis, like if they were having suicidal thoughts, abusing drugs, or struggling to raise a teenager. Third Level helped people who didn't have anywhere else to turn.
I found a home I didn't really have in many other places at Third Level.
That's Megan Morrissey, a youth crisis worker at the organization. She began volunteering at the crisis line 4 years ago, when she was in college. At that time, she was grieving the death of her father. She was also facing homelessness and navigating adulthood with little support from home. For Megan, Third Level was a safe haven.
They saved my life countless times, and I know that they saved so many lives, and they helped so many people. People knew us and could drive by and see the lights on, know there's just always going to be a person there.
She says that helped build trust and a sense of safety. Third Level's crisis line served 18 counties in northern Michigan. But in April, The crisis hotline shut down.
It really did feel like the death of someone. That was highly emotional.
Mental health agencies all over the region had helped fund it, but they all ended their contracts, eliminating the crisis line's primary source of income and forcing it to close. Many of those organizations switched to a company called Protocol, a national crisis hotline. Their closest call center? It's in Grand Rapids, 150 miles away. So why'd they switch? When asked about money, a spokesperson for North Country Community Mental Health didn't want to comment on the cost difference between Protocol and Third Level. She said she didn't have to answer that. Carl Kovacs is the CEO of Northern Lakes Community Mental Health Authority. He didn't want to give specifics either, but says the contract costs between Third Level and Protocol were similar, and that they switched because Protocol simply has more mental health professionals.
It's a bigger system. It's a larger company. We feel that that's a higher level of service for the people we serve who will be calling that phone line.
Third Level had licensed staff, but they also relied on trained volunteers from the community. All over the country, mental health agencies are increasingly funding national call centers, putting small local ones out of business.
The stories of the call centers that close are often an unsung story. It happens slowly and it happens relatively quietly.
That's Travis Atkinson. He's from the American Association of Suicidology.
The funding dries up. Other organizations that have developed a national presence will come in, and because of their efficiencies and how they provide crisis call services, they can do it at a lower rate.
But these national call centers, they can't always provide the sort of personalized care that local crisis centers, like Third Level, can.
People are less connected than they used to be.
There is strength in a well-connected and local mental health community.
Especially in areas where people are isolated.
Relationship is so much more important in rural areas.
According to the Center for Disease Control and Prevention, rural counties consistently have higher suicide rates than urban ones. Their rates are around 45% higher. Third Level doesn't have their crisis line service anymore, but they do still offer legal aid, suicide prevention workshops, and youth programs. Mickey Genazzo is director of Youth and Crisis Services.
We're still here doing things that help young people and make our communities safer from suicide and help meet legal needs. We're still here.
That report was from Bronte Cook. You're listening to Stateside. I'm Cynthia Canty. 42 years ago this month, legendary comedian Groucho Marx died of pneumonia. He was 86 years old. His show business career was legendary, but his final years are a cautionary tale of elder abuse and the importance of end-of-life planning. U of M medical historian and PBS contributor Dr. Howard Markell is here with Groucho's story, and I know you well enough to realize that your first inspiration for being a physician was Groucho. Other people had other kinds of inspirations,
yeah,
like Ben Casey and Dr. Kildare.
Or Jonas Salk, you know.
Yeah, but
no,
for you,
me,
it's Groucho.
It was Groucho. He was Dr. Hugo Z. Hackenbush in A Day at the Races. He's actually a veterinarian who gets a job at a people hospital. And he has one of the best lines I've ever heard. I've always wanted to say it, but I've never had the guts, where he takes a patient's pulse and he says, "Either this patient is dead or my watch is stopped." And it's just such a brilliant line, but I've never had the guts. I think that would shock my patients.
I think it would shock your patients. Yeah. Briefly recap his show business career for maybe younger listeners, yeah, who aren't as familiar with Groucho.
I always assign Marx Brother movies to my students, actually, because they're so wonderful and hilarious. But Groucho and his brothers, Harpo and Chico, and sometimes Zeppo, he dropped out of the act early on, were vaudeville stars. They traveled all across the country as teenagers and young adults. They then conquered Broadway with three great hits that were the toast of the town, and then later films well into the 1940s. And then, of course, Groucho had a solo career as a game show host called You Bet Your Life, which is no ordinary game show, because Groucho was so funny and could ad-lib so well that when he interviewed his contestants, you never knew what was going to happen. It's just a hilarious show.
So he truly, you know, cut across the, yeah, boards as far as his show business career. What of his later years?
Well, that's really sad. So He was rather estranged from his children. Arthur Marx, who was a writer, his first son, wrote a book about Groucho called Son of Groucho, and Groucho got very offended by that. It's really not that offensive. It's a very nice book, actually. And his daughter Miriam had a long struggle with drug and alcohol abuse. And then he had another child with his second wife. He divorced his first wife, Melinda, who was often on his show, You Bet Your Life, and later got all confused by the flower children in the 60s, mm-hmm. and they became estranged. So he had a girlfriend in the 70s named Erin Fleming, who was in her 30s. And she was a bit actor in movies, and she had aspirations of Hollywood grandeur. And so she controlled his life, basically. She did get him to go back on the stage, and he did in the early 70s a show called An Evening with Groucho, which is quite funny. Marvin Hamlisch was his accompanist, and there's an album or a CD now of it. But you could tell when you're hearing him, he's quite old and forgetful and would forget his lines. So he had some elements of dementia near the end of his life. But she would control him, boss him around, and she later controlled his estate. He made her his executor. He even tried to adopt her so that she could inherit all of his money. And, of course, the Marx children didn't like this control. And it really bordered on abuse. And we talk about elder abuse today. It probably has gone on for a long time, but it's a new phrase.
It's very much on the radar today, right. But back in the 70s,
nobody knew it. It wasn't even called that at the time. Just as child abuse, the term child abuse enters the literature, the medical literature, in 1964 or 1965. Now, of course, children had been abused in a variety of ways since there were children. But as far as doctors and social workers and nurses recognizing it as a medicalized disease entity, if you will, that's a rather new phenomenon, and especially for elder abuse is even more recent than that.
And so this overarching problem was the elder abuse and also lack of end-of-life planning.
Right. He didn't have the right will or the right directives. Living wills didn't even exist back then. You know, what do you want to do if this happens or that happens? This is, they've been derided in recent years as so-called death panels. They're nothing of the sort. The idea that you would speak with your doctor and your lawyer about what you want to do near the end of your life while you're still competent, mentally competent, is a really great idea because it's a tragedy that unfolds in every hospital every day across the United States and elsewhere as well because it's a worldwide problem now.
And what kind of health issues did he deal with as his life?
Well, he had dementia. He had a lot of cardiac problems. He had some heart attacks and the end result, heart failure. He broke his hip once and then it was repaired and then broke it again. So he had it was a very common story for any of us who have taken care of our elderly parents. And the dementia is a particularly difficult problem, especially then because we didn't know much about it. But it must be very frustrating for an adult child to deal with a parent who doesn't remember things and doesn't remember even who they are.
Who's already estranged from that parent.
Right.
So even after his death, were things ugly afterwards?
Yeah. Even on his deathbed, there were, he developed pneumonia, which used to be called the old man's friend because it carries you away quite quickly if you don't treat it. But his children were basically fighting in legal battles as he was in a hospital dying. And this went on actually for many, many years until the early 80s. And Erin Fleming was actually found guilty of bilking the estate out of at least $500,000 or more and had to pay that back to the estate. And the children actually got not only the money that Groucho had, but his name and image in this era of branding and everything is on water bottles or T-shirts.
Sure.
That was a big issue as well. But what was really sad was that he did not have a good relationship with any of his children.
What lessons can we learn from this sad ending of Groucho Marx? Even though we are addressing elder abuse, we're addressing bullying of elders, what can we learn from this?
Well, the first lesson, I think, is planning. And it's never too early to meet with your attorney and your physician, with your spouse or your children, and to talk about these issues with your children. And a lot of parents don't want to do that. It's my business. It's my control.
Who wants to talk about death.
Right. And also, what are you going to do with your assets? Mm-hmm. Even your what my grandfather would call your tchotchkes, your mm-hmm. stuff. Mm-hmm. And so that gets very difficult as well. But we all have to know more about recognizing it. And caregivers need breaks. If they're with that individual for a long period of time, even if they're not an abuser per se, bad behavior can result when you're the only person caring for someone who needs a lot of care. So we all need help, and that's something to think about. But it's a public health problem that all of us need to think about because the population is aging, and people live a lot longer than they did. When Groucho died at 86, that was an old man. Mm-hmm. And now we see the obituaries 90s and the 100s. So the problems don't go away with age. They actually combine and transmogrify.
Marking the death of legendary comedian Groucho Marx. As always, University of Michigan medical historian and PBS contributor, Dr. Howard Markell, thank you so much.
Thank you.
The haunting call of the common loon. To some people, that is lakes in Michigan. Well, these beautiful calls are threatened here in our state. The common loon is considered threatened. Let's talk about why. As we welcome Joe Kaplan, he's a biologist and co-director of Common Coast Research and Conservation. Joe, I do think these haunting vocalizations is part of what makes everybody just say, oh, I love the loon. Is it fair to think of the loon kind of as the symbol of up north?
You know, you're right on the mark. There's a lot of people that, take its vocalization, see its the aesthetic of the loon, its black and white plumage is an icon of the North. And you are not alone in that regard.
Tell us more about the loon. I mean, describe more what it looks like and especially the life cycle and what its preferred habitat is.
Yeah, you bet. Well, it's a obligate water bird. So it spends its entire life on the water. And it's topography is pretty much like the deciding factor there is its legs are set way back on its body. So it's incapable of actually walking on land. So that's one of the first things that sets it up for vulnerability when it comes into conflict with humans is it needs 28 days, nice quiet shoreline for incubating its eggs. Those are hard traits to find in a lot of Michigan where there's people. So that's another reason why it's considered sort of a indicator of wilderness values. Another thing about bird, the loon, is it's a relatively large bird. It has solid bones, unlike most birds, bones that are hollow. And that just prepares it for sort of a life completely on the water, except for that short time that it's nesting each season in early spring. It's a migratory bird, and that's primarily because all of its habitat, inland lakes, freeze over in the wintertime. So it spends actually most of its time, most of its life on the ocean, returning to inland lakes in the north for breeding. So it's in many respects, it's like a seabird.
So how much risk is the loon in here in Michigan? What do the numbers tell us?
Well, it's hard to get handles on numbers because we have about 10,000 lakes in Michigan. But our estimates, doing this work for about 30 years, we would estimate there's probably about 800 pairs of loons on Michigan's 10,000 lakes, which sounds encouraging, though that really has to be viewed in what's happened to the loon over the last 100 years. 100 years ago, this was a bird that was common on early chroniclers of loons in Michigan indicated it was common on just about every inland lake. There was a breeding pair. So where I'm originally from, I live in the UP now, but I'm originally from Oakland County. There's about 400 lakes, and that was 400 loons pairs that basically disappeared between 1900 and 1953.
Mm. So, I'm hearing what you're saying.
Yeah. So they did a rapid decline and disappeared from the southern third of the state since they've been listed as a threatened species in 1987. Prompted by some low survey results of about 500 birds, it's held its own. And I think that's primarily because people, because they respect the loon, have taken measures for conservation, not just at the agency level, but most importantly, by people that live with loons where loons still occur on their inland lakes.
People care. What is avian botulism? Is that also a threat?
Oh, yeah. Avian botulism is something that first appeared or documented in the lakes in Lake Michigan, 1960. to about 1982 was the last outbreak. And at that time, it wasn't really known what was causing it, but in hindsight, it likely was alewives, that small foraging fish that was introduced into the lake that had a really unfortunate life history attribute of dying in mass after they bred in the fall. And botulism can only, that bacterium, the Clostridium bacteria, can only exist where there's no oxygen. So oxygen has to be depleted. And that's exactly what happened up until 1980. And then in 1999, it began again. And it's unfortunately linked to invasive mussels. And then this round goby that eats the mussels and then moves up the food chain during migration into not just loons anymore, but grebes, white-winged scoters, long-tailed ducks, terns, things like that.
You know, what you're describing strikes me as a big ecological Jenga game.
Yeah, that's collapsed. Yeah. So we've had, on Lake Michigan, we've had outbreaks since 2006. We had a major outbreak in 2007, then in 2009, 12. Mm. So we keep setting the blocks back up. But when it happens, you know, we lose thousands of water birds. Big proportion of those are loons.
So between a disease brought in by these invasive species and the fact that we love living around lakes.
yeah.
But you made it very clear, people taking action has at least helped stabilize the loon population. So give us an idea, how can people who are listening to us talk right now, how can we better protect the common loon?
I would say three things. There's three things that our study of loons have you know, using them as a bioindicator. Certainly getting away from any emissions of mercury. And we've done a very good job on everything except for coal-fired power plants. That's a source of environmental mercury. So it's taken out of the ground where it's sequestered, not interacting with life on the surface. And then it's put into the atmosphere as a consequence of burning it for energy. And then once it's deposited in the lakes, it becomes an organic form, which is highly toxic. So that's one, reducing as much mercury as we can as far as a release in the environment. Getting away from lead fishing tackle and being responsible with your monofilament, that's a leading cause of death in adult loons. You know, learning about their natural history and giving them that space during the 28 days that they're incubating. And then finally, making policies that prevent any more introductions of invasive species into the Great Lakes. It that is just, it's been just a horrible, it's unintended, but the consequences are really staggering.
Joe, what do you like best about the loon?
You know, I have to say I like their dedication to their territories, to their chicks, and I like their longevity. We're going to grow old with loons we were growing old with loons until botulism, but we still, you know, I've been doing this work since 1990, and I'm studying a bird that's 32 years old this year, banded as a chick back in 1987. He's been paired with the same mate since he was 11. So they're over 20 years together. They've raised 34 chicks. Many of his and her offspring have returned to the refuge and around the UP to establish. So, yeah, they're dedicated to what they do. And, you know, I look forward to talking to you when we can talk about a 50-year-old loon at Saney. That'd be awesome.
Well, we would love to do that as well. Joe Kaplan, biologist and the co-director of Common Coast Research and Conservation. Thanks so much for spending time with us.
Oh, my pleasure. You're welcome. Have a great day.
More than 300 people braved the Straits of Mackinac Sunday. It was the 13th annual Mighty Mac Swim. Michigan Radio's Kay LaFond rode along on a security boat. She got a firsthand look at what goes into herding swimmers across all 4 miles of the Straits.
The day started with a beautiful sunrise at 6:34 a.m. Shortly after, about 340 swimmers were in the water. Each was attached to a big orange buoy for visibility.
As you can see, the swimmers are underway.
I was riding along on the Grand Traverse Band of Ottawa and Chippewa's Fisheries Enforcement Boat. That's radio communications you're hearing. Their boat was one of 12 law enforcement vessels on the water, along with more than a dozen civilian boats. The straits are closed to general boat traffic during the 4-hour swim, so part of our job was to make sure nobody else got too close. but we were also on the lookout for swimmers who needed to be pulled from the water. The first person ran out of steam within the first 30 minutes.
Swimmer is tired, swimmer is okay. I'll be transporting to the ferry.
The water started calm but got progressively choppier. Swimmers had to make checkpoints within a certain time frame. They also had to stay within a certain distance of the bridge.
Hey, you gotta move over. Gotta get back in the lane.
As we got closer to St. Ignace, lots of swimmers started to drift too far east due to the currents and had to get pulled out of the water.
If they don't want to do it for themselves, please tell them they are putting others in danger. They need to get on that boat.
Chris Gates of Grand Rapids completed his second swim this year. He said a lot of people had trouble staying on course.
You weren't swimming kind of at a 45-degree angle. You'd actually kind of get sucked out because of the current. So if you just swam straight, you'd be, you know, kicked way out east.
But at the end of the day, nearly 300 of the 340 or so swimmers were able to finish it, the fastest in an impressive hour and 30 minutes. For Michigan Radio, I'm Kay LaFond.
When we tend to think of Native American businesses, one of the first things comes to people's mind might be a casino. But some tribes are working to broaden and diversify their business endeavors. The Sault Ste. Marie Tribe of Chippewa Indians, for one. They've received a federal grant to set up a manufacturing center on their land in the Upper Peninsula. And they're hoping to see that become an economic driver for the tribe and for the region. Joel Schultz is with us. He's Economic Development Director for the Sault Ste. Marie Tribe. Good to have you here, Joel.
Thank you for having me.
So how big is this grant and what's it going to allow the tribe to do?
Well, the project is a $2.35 million project. The grant from the Economic Development Administration is $2 million. And we also have participation from the Michigan Economic Development Corporation for $250,000 and direct investment of $100,000 plus the land and resources. So it's over a $2.35 million project. And, it's a 20,000 square foot construction of industrial light manufacturing space. And, what it does, you know, the second part of the question is it gives the tribe a tool to work with its tribal members and businesses to come take advantage of some of those often cited, never utilized programs that are available on reservation land.
So give me an idea. When this manufacturing center, this 20,000 square foot center is up and running, where will it be located and what will be happening in it?
So it's on Seymour, which would be just outside of the city limits in Sault Ste. Marie, Michigan. We have a tenant committed to it, a Sioux Tribe member, a business based out of Neenah, Wisconsin. Earlier this year, we completed some professional space downtown on trust land. And Jetta Corporation was one of the first companies to commit and lease some office space and create a presence on our reservation. And they also have agreed to lease 5,000 of the 20,000 square feet. We're building the building so it can have multiple tenants. And so the first tenant is going to be an industrial distributor that's discovered opportunities in Canada associated with the recent tariff applications and the fact that the tribe automatically qualifies as a foreign trade zone. They're looking to obtain that status and do some value-added manufacturing at the border and create an economic advantage to selling products and working with Canadian manufacturers. And they're going to build on their business that's already in energy generation as their specialty. They're a supplier and manufacturer for that industry. So that's the first tenant. The what we envision filling the building are those calls that we've got. I've been with the tribe about 2 years, and we frequently get calls saying, you know, we're interested in being on tribal land. We're a tribal member. We're interested in starting a business, growing a business. And, you know, entrepreneurs typically are on a fast timeline, and we did not have space, you know. So we could talk about constructing space, dedicating space, different things, but often those conversations fizzle when you're starting to look at a 6-8 month timeline. So the idea is we got that anchor tenant. We know we have demand for the facility. We can anticipate additional demand with the pending Sioux Lock projects and the vertical inventory for the area. We've worked with EUP Planning and Development. This is an asset that's not in the region, so it won't only benefit the tribe, it'll benefit the entire region for attraction and business growth. And we think we're going to fill it with light, small manufacturers. And we hope we fill it quickly, and we hope we build the second building because we selected a site that has room for growth.
So it's a second building is also kind of on the back burner, but you'd like to see that go onto the front burner and get built.
Well, we're going to learn, right? We're going to go into this. We anticipate the type of businesses. We have a specific example of the type of business we're going to attract, and we're going to build a building to try to accommodate that. And I bet you we make mistakes, but hopefully what we do throughout the whole thing is learn and generate additional demand and grow the business. And so, yes, we have acreage now, and as soon as we get a certain occupancy rate on this space, then we have a proven model, and we're going to the next one.
Joel, how much of the Sioux Tribe's revenue comes from casino operations?
That's a complicated question. So if you're talking about the governmental operations or the overall revenue, those type of things, but it's a large percentage. You know, I mean, it's a big financial contributor yet. The market's changed. We don't have the same competitive advantage as to when we built the first casino in the state of Michigan. And it doesn't create the windfalls maybe that have been described in the past, but it's a major contributor to the governmental structure. And then if you just went by gross revenues of the tribe, it's a high percentage.
Remind us how many casinos?
We have 5 casinos in the Eastern UP.
And so how will this manufacturing center change that conversation and change perceptions of the tribe's business endeavors?
The manufacturing center itself is a tool. And I think all tribes are facing the challenge that the economy created by casinos isn't as significant as it used to be. It's a shrinking market. Competition is finding ways to enter on an ongoing basis. And that was an advantage that tribes had, is that industry. But we also have advantages in other industries, especially in government contracting. And so if we're going to work with 8A socially disadvantaged business type statuses that give big advantages to companies in selling to the government, we need space, right? So the tool is the space. We need to develop relationships. We need to become more savvy on the processes. And the companies that we're talking to about the space now are all in that arena. And, the Alaskan Native corporations have led the way, and their gross revenues in government contracting are far larger than what ours are in gaming. So, we're looking to diversify into those opportunities. We realize that government isn't always the best at business. And so we're kind of targeting working with our Sioux Tribe members. We have 44,000 plus members spread across the world. We're going to try to attract some of them back, and we're going to try to work with them to get the statuses and to create the economy on our lands.
So let's pretend we're talking in 10 years. You and I have circled back and we're conversing again. What is the business and economic story that you want to be telling about the tribe, about the Sault Ste. Marie tribe, and also the Upper Peninsula region where you live and work?
Yeah, so I think starting with the regional concept is, I think a lot of markets are finding this, is we won't do it on our own. We don't have enough Native Americans living on the reservation to house the industrial growth that we would want, right? And it's going to be a regional effort. And we need to cooperate with our partners in the area like we did in this grant application and worked with the EUP planning and the Intertribal Council and those agencies to fit their overall master plan. But where we'd want to be is less dependent on the gaming industry, creating jobs that are more family sustainable than what the hospitality industry yields, and having growth in economy that would support the housing growth and the family growth and the population growth necessary for our region to thrive. So we've, as a small start, and we've identified space that we're developing for retail hospitality purposes other than gaming. We have identified professional space to be headquarters and to attract tribal members back to conduct global business with the advantages of reservations. And then, of course, this industrial manufacturing type thing. So we're trying to get a diversified base of tools in place that allow and create opportunities for our members and others in the region. So 10 years from now, we hope that we're building upon that and taking the next step. And those next steps are typically, we need to get a innovation center, technology. We need, the next step are to build upon those foundation blocks and start creating larger economies and be in the heart of it as the tribe and the reservation to be able to financially benefit.
And finally, Joel, when do you expect this manufacturing center to be built up and running?
Well, I'd like to have it done next week. But the reality is we're dealing with federal funding and we're a government agency on our own, and it's going to be a methodical timeline. But with that said, we're hoping early spring, midsummer, to have tenants and be operating. So that's on me to push through the systems to try to get everything in place to accomplish that. No one's saying they don't want that to happen. It's just a lot of when you're dealing with federal funds, we're going to have to do it all right, and we're going to have to document it, and it takes some time. But you know, next summer is when I'd like to have the conversation and say we were right. We filled this building up. It's creating economy. It's growing our local base, and now we want to do more. And what we learned is this is where we should do it.
Well, so, it's a date. Let's have you back, and we'll have that conversation next summer.
Sounds great.
Joel Schultz, Economic Development Director for the Sault Ste. Marie Tribe of Chippewa Indians. Thanks for spending time with us, Joel.
Thank you.
All this week, we're going to focus on climate change and how it will affect us here in the state of Michigan. It is a huge crisis that faces our generation and generations to come. It'll affect every aspect of our lives, from what we eat to how we travel to how we live inside our homes. Michigan Radio's Tracy Samilton is here now to talk about the big picture for the state of Michigan. Tracy, let's just start at the very beginning. What is climate change and why is it happening?
So climate change describes what's happening to our environment as the planet's atmosphere is warming up. And that warming is happening because of an increase in greenhouse gases, primarily carbon dioxide, but also methane and some other gases. And those gases are almost all of them coming from us. Whenever we produce and burn a fossil fuel, including coal, natural gas, gasoline, diesel, propane, the like, and also from our clearing of the world's forests, which trap carbon dioxide.
And boy, we can see and feel that warming is happening already. I just got back from touring France with a group of Michigan Radio listeners. So we were there for the highest temperatures France had ever recorded. We had 104 degrees in the Loire Valley. So I certainly wasn't surprised at this new report that July was the hottest month in recorded history. So we know it's global, but it's going to look somewhat different based on where you live. Let's talk about Michigan. What's it going to look like in Michigan?
Well, it is going to make things hotter in Michigan, that's for sure, especially in the summer. And we had a taste of what is to come in mid-July. We had 3-4 days of nearly a 100-degree heat index. And that's the combination of heat and humidity that just feels incredibly oppressive. And it's dangerous, too. So imagine having that happen not just a handful of times a year, but up to 25 days a year. The Union of Concerned Scientists says if we do nothing to curtail our emissions, that's in our future by mid-century. And 26 to 50 days of those extreme heat waves a year by late century if we do nothing.
Well, we call it climate change now and not just global warming because the heat's going to do other things, right? Like here in Michigan, we're seeing an increase already in these intense and more frequent rainstorms and flooding.
Yeah, we have seen that. And we've seen an increase about 14% of precipitation in the Great Lakes region since 1951. That's expected to continue. But weather is harder to predict than the temperature increases. So it could be back and forth. We could have years of really dry, hot summers in Michigan with super wet springs. And we could have more lake effect snow in the winters. But as it continues to get warmer, we could have a lot more rain in the winter.
So this is an area where the science is not as settled as it is with temperature increases. What about our Great Lakes? Because we all remember 6 years ago, we had near record lows in some of the lakes. This year, everybody's talking about near record highs, which causes a lot of problems with erosion and people's homes flooding and marina owners really being hurt. Is more of that in our future?
The answer is probably. This is one of the biggest areas of uncertainty right now for Great Lakes climate scientists. Will we see more of this rapid shifting from low to high levels and back again? But the research is definitely leaning towards yes on that one.
What else might we see in the Great Lakes?
Oh, boy. It's a long and not very happy list. Maybe more E. coli contamination on beaches, more severe cyanobacterial blooms in the lakes, changes in our fish populations and forests. I guess there's one positive thing to mention, and that's that it's going to be so much worse in the south. It's so hot that people may actually have to move, and they may move here.
All right. So you mentioned a couple of times, Tracy, that this is if we do nothing. Let's talk first about what we can do to prepare for climate change and then what we can do to slow climate change, because some of it is coming no matter what we do, right?
That is right. So the carbon dioxide we're putting into the atmosphere right now, it remains there for hundreds, if not thousands of years. So even if we stopped all fossil fuel burning and deforestation tomorrow, the planet is still going to warm up from the CO2 that we pumped into the atmosphere before. So you mentioned when you were in Paris, mm-hmm. it was a terrible heat wave. But that city has an emergency plan that it developed after the last deadly heat wave in 2003. So they do things now like checking up on the most vulnerable people in the city, making sure they have ways to get cool. And they dramatically lowered heat deaths compared to that last heat wave. So our Michigan cities need to be doing things like that. They can go to the Red Cross, which just issued a comprehensive report on what steps to take. And because of that flooding, yeah. our cities also have to make changes to our infrastructure to deal with flood events.
All right. Let's talk about what we can do, really what we can do to try to reduce carbon emissions and limit the impact of climate change. We can't all afford to immediately run out and buy an electric car and put solar panels on our roofs. And it's clearly a bigger problem than just individual behavior. So what could each of us do that has a bigger impact?
So I asked Richard Rood that exact question, what can we do? He teaches climate change problem solving at the University of Michigan, and his answer kind of surprised me. He tells his students to run for local office.
Start thinking about how to work within their homeowners associations, how to work within getting elected to city councils and school boards to start to have influence on local policy.
Hmm.
Yeah. He says these local and city and state policies, also regional multi-state efforts, could really move the needle on energy efficiency and renewable energy, public transportation, and reforestation. And, you know, these local and state and regional efforts are really crucial right now because the Trump administration is, in fact, rolling back policies that address climate change. I also asked this question of Margaretta Kearney. She's with the Environmental Law and Policy Center, and she agrees with Rood. She says, get involved. If your city doesn't have a climate change plan, demand one. Or if there is one, but the city's not meeting its goals, hold your elected leaders accountable. She says, vote for people who promise to do something about climate change and hold them accountable. Hold corporations accountable.
We can force the people who represent us in government and the companies who sell things to us, we can insist that they change the way they are responding to climate change and that they take much more significant action. And that bigger system change, I think, is where there can be a real impact on carbon emissions.
And we have heard of businesses realizing it is smart business to be environmentally aware and to take mm-hmm. kind of actions. And you've just gotten wind of an environmental initiative that Governor Whitmer is launching.
Yeah, last week she announced a plan to direct state departments to look at ways they can reduce their energy use and increase energy efficiency. And that includes an initiative over at our state prisons where they're going to be installing solar panels to make the prisons greener.
Well, we'll be talking a lot more about environmental issues and how people are responding with action all this week. Meantime, you can get lots of information and resources by going to michiganradio.org. Tracy Samilton, always great. Thanks so much.
You're welcome.
Tomorrow on Stateside, the head of the Detroit Zoo talks about efforts to lead a community conversation about climate change and conservation efforts. Ron Kagan says it all starts with kids.
Kids tend to be very receptive to wanting to do positive things. And after all, they're the ones who are going to inherit Earth and whatever is left of nature.
That's tomorrow on Stateside. I'm Cynthia Canty. Thank you so very much for listening.